Talking about our sexual relationship and our marriage is both very difficult and very courageous, and it helps us work toward making our spouse very special. It works toward valuing them.
Welcome again to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon. In today's program, Dr. Jack Crabtree and marriage and family therapist Christine Barber talk about the importance of sexuality in a marriage commitment. Why is sexuality such an important part of marriage? And why is breaking the marriage vow sexually so devastating to so many marriages? Let's listen now to Jack and Christine as they discuss this crucial subject.
Jack, we've had a number of talks about marriage, and the last several weeks have been how we violate our marriage commitment or our marriage vow. There's lots of ways that we do that. The one that we've come to today is that we need to behave in a way that communicates that my spouse is special. We want to look at how do I violate that vow.
We cannot help at this point then talking about sexuality and the way in which we violate that vow as we relate to one another sexually in marriage.
Now, remember early on, one of my first classes in school where we talked about sexuality was a very difficult one for me, because I wasn't familiar with the subject and I wasn't comfortable with my own sexuality. In fact, I think I was very uncomfortable with my sexuality. I hold that discomfort in common, as I found out through my counseling, with many, many people.
Yeah, I think it's a natural, God-given reticence that we have. I think intuitively we recognize how deeply personal and how deeply nobody else's business my sexuality is. A kind of natural modesty, and that we shouldn't be ashamed of that. I mean, it's one of the greatest tragedies of modern sex education and the current cultural attitudes toward sexuality, is that you have people in trying to strip us of that modesty, stripping children of their modesty and pushing adults to abandon that modesty. And it's a huge mistake. It ought to be an uncomfortable topic to talk about.
And yet over the years, it has become more comfortable for me.
But probably, if it's anything like me, not because you are any less modest than you were before, but you realize that in certain contexts it's absolutely crucial that you shed some light on a topic that otherwise people are incredibly confused about, and it can be very destructive in their lives, and the only way to help them is to be able to talk to them about it.
In some ways, I have become more modest in the sense that I value my sexuality more, I understand it more, I see it more clearly, and I want to honor it a lot. And I have spent a lot of time with people talking about their sexuality. Individuals that come in with very large concerns, especially in the last 5 years, about their sexual identity. A lot of people that come in with concerns about their sexual relationship with their spouse. Very often, almost invariably, people come in and are very embarrassed, have a very difficult time talking about it, think that they're the only ones who are this way. I have found that that's not true at all. People come in with the same issues over and over and over again, of course expressed through their different personalities. But people have a lot of very common issues that they're struggling with, and most people struggle in some way with their sexuality. And I consider them to be courageous, brave people, to be opening up to another person and talking about such an intimate subject in a way that they do in trying to learn, in trying to figure out, in trying to use their sexuality in the way that God purposed it to be used.
So the point is that we may talk very freely about some personal subjects, but it's because it needs to be done.
It really needs to be done, and it needs to be taken out of the closet. In fact, it needs to be taken out of our counseling offices and talked about.
Jack and Christine will be back in just a few moments. Here's something about Jack Crabtree. Years ago, he began to seriously study the book of Romans. So what, you say? Lots of people study the book of Romans. Well, the more Jack studied, the more he began to see a difference between what he had always believed Christianity to be all about and what the book of Romans was telling him. The difference bothered him, and he had to get to the bottom of it. What emerged was a fresh and insightful understanding of the gospel, an understanding that changed his life. Over the years, Jack has taught on the book of Romans, other books of the Bible, and numerous topics. In each case, he brings his desire to get to the bottom of it. He believes that it's worth our while to seek out truth, even if it's hard work. Christine Barber is a professional marriage and family therapist. Because she works closely with people who are suffering and struggling through life's toughest problems, she has to be committed to truth. This means being committed to her clients' best interest, to their growth as wise people, and to see real change in people's lives being the work of God. For her, the answers to life's big questions are rooted in the truth of God's Word. She sees this world as the arena where God grows us up into wise people who love the things of God and look forward to His kingdom. Now, here again are Jack and Christine.
So, Jack, there's a number of ways that we can misuse our sexuality in our marriages.
Well, maybe we should put it in the context of where we've been going. We've talked about the four different aspects of the vow, of our marriage vow, to strive to become one with one another, to strive to become one with my spouse as another person, as different from I am, as different from me, making my spouse the highest human loyalty that I have, granting a loyalty to them that's higher than my loyalty to anyone else or anything else. And then in this last one that we want to talk about, we are making a promise to my spouse to make them the most special person in my life. That's very closely related to the loyalty. But beyond loyalty, I'm making a promise to my spouse to communicate to them their dearness to me, to communicate to them how precious and valuable they are to me, how uniquely precious they are to me. And I may have mentioned in the past, it seems to me that it's that aspect of the vow that is really at the heart of where the joy of marriage comes from. The reward, we've talked about how difficult marriage can be, how much pain it can cause in my life, and how much agony it can cause in my life. And the pain and the anguish that is entailed there is an important part of the purpose of marriage, I think, in God's plan. Because as we have discussed, it's a kind of classroom. I can grow in wisdom, I can grow in character, I can grow in my faith and my belief in the context of marriage. But what's the reward of marriage out of all this pain and suffering? Beyond the eternal reward of being qualified for the kingdom of God, is there any joy that comes in the midst of the agony of life? Yes, there is. And I think at the heart of it, it's when my spouse keeps this promise and treasures me and holds me to be a valuable and dear human being to them. There's a tremendous amount of joy that comes from that. I just assume that God has created my psyche to really respond to that. It makes me feel like a whole person in an important way.
Joy is a good word. In fact, it is not a joy that's always giddy, but it's a joy that's certainly very deep and very enduring and in some ways very satisfying to our human psyche. I certainly think we were built to want that and to appreciate being valued, being dear to somebody, as you said, being treasured. And I agree with you. I think that is by far the best part of marriage, and I think it's an incredible gift.
Well, that's where we have to talk about sexuality, because it seems to me that when we get a chance later to lay out a whole theory of sexuality, that it's in sexuality that God has given me the language that I can use to communicate that specialness of my spouse. There's really no other thing in all of my life that I can withhold from every other human being in the world around me and grant to my spouse and do so righteously. I mean, do so with integrity and in love. I can't withhold my time from other people. I can't withhold my financial resources, material resources from other people. You know, I would be stingy, I would be selfish, I would be unloving to not be prepared to take the opportunity to give of my time, to give of my energy, to give of my material resources. But I do not need to give of myself sexually to anybody. I am not denying them anything that is their right or their due or even anything that they need. Therefore, it's the one thing that I can righteously withhold from everybody in the world except my wife or husband. And it becomes an important symbol and token of how special they are, of how precious they are to me, that I would allow them and only them to have a sexual and intimate knowledge of me.
So the act of being sexual itself says you are special, but even more so, the whole giving it only to my spouse makes it even more special.
Exactly.
It's both those things.
Exactly. So it seems that there's two ways that we violate that then. Let me just speak from the male perspective because I know that a little bit better, I think.
I imagine you know that a lot better. I'll tell you what, I'll speak from the female perspective,
okay,
and you can speak from the male perspective.
That's a good idea. When a man lusts after other women, for example, and there are other ways that we could violate this vow, but when a man lusts after other women, allows himself to do that, it seems to me that he's doing two things. He's blurring or marring the exclusiveness of his sexual desire, and therefore he's blurring and marring this symbol of sexuality as a token of his wife's specialness. Speaking just from the perspective of a male, when a husband lusts after other women, you know, whether it's looking at photographs of naked women, pornography, girl watching, either making explicit that he's lusting after other women, or just not making it explicit, keeping it a secret in his own head, that he's lusting after other women. He's really destroying the value of sexuality to communicate to his wife her specialness. I think there's two things happening there, it seems to me. On the one hand, if a man allows himself to just see desire for another woman as merely another physical desire and thinks that it's harmless as long as he doesn't act on it, and that's usually the rationale, I think, that men would use. I'm not acting on it. I'm not committing adultery. I'm not having sex with other women. I'm just thinking about it. I'm just daydreaming about it or something.
And my wife doesn't know about it.
And my wife doesn't know about it, usually, yeah. He thinks that it's harmless, but it's destructive at two levels. On the one hand, he's allowing himself to see his sexuality as merely a physical desire. But if it's merely a physical desire, then any woman would do. It can't help, but at least at a kind of an unconscious level, a kind of undercurrent in the relationship, to whatever extent his wife realizes that his sexual appetite is merely a physical appetite and is not in any way informed by who he is as a rational and moral creature, to whatever extent she can pick up on the fact that it's merely a physical appetite, it seems to me that it demeans, it robs it of any meaning. And it certainly robs her of a sense of her specialness, because she could be any woman and meet a physical appetite. It's only when it has the meaning and significance of communicating and symbolizing to her, you are the most precious person in the world, that sexual relationship is only meaningful with her.
Very often when I see couples that come in for marriage counseling, a concern is that one person or the other, usually the man, is very upset with the wife that he's not getting the sex that he deserves, is often the way that he puts it, or his wife isn't giving him sex. And I think what you're talking about really cuts at the very core of what's going on for the spouse that doesn't want to be sexual, usually the wife, because she's not feeling special. She's feeling like she's just something to be used to satisfy the man's sexual desire. She feels like she's not at all special, not at all unique, not not necessarily even being responded to as a wife, but being responded to as a body. And very often women find that they can't respond sexually. They find themselves unable to respond, even if they had the desire. But I think what I find is that the desire and the response are not there.
Oftentimes in the magazines and so on, you have articles about the way to prepare for a sexual experience, the kind of romancing, the kind of what they would even call a kind of foreplay, where kindness during the day and so on is part of the foreplay of sexuality. I think that's what you're describing, is if the sexual intimacy is put in the context of a relationship of caring and love and so on, then it becomes a meaningful relationship in a way that it's not if it's merely a physical act. We shouldn't be fooled by that. Men can learn to manipulate that. They can learn to lie with their actions, with their flattery, with their attention, with their kindnesses, with their graces, in order to get sex. And that's a game that men are fully capable of playing. But I think it reflects a reality, and that is that a woman wants this to be a meaningful act, and men are quite able and willing to not have it be a meaningful act, but just have it be physical gratification, pure and simple. For a Christian, that's inexcusable. It's inexcusable, certainly outside of marriage, as we will talk about when we talk about sexuality, but it's inexcusable in the context of marriage as well.
Let's pause for a few minutes and come back and talk about why it's inexcusable in the context of a Christian marriage.
Jack and Christine will be back in a moment. First, here's a question. What does it mean to take the Bible seriously? Does it mean that you carry your Bible with you everywhere you go? Well, maybe. Does it mean that you read it every day? Could be. Does it mean that you believe what it teaches is true? Certainly. But how do you know what the Bible really teaches? The staff of the McKenzie Study Center believes that discovering what the biblical authors meant when they wrote the Bible is central to taking the Bible seriously. At the heart of McKenzie is a desire to let the text speak for itself, to understand the Bible the way its authors intended. They believe the truth contained in the Bible offers a radical message for our world. They also believe that studying the Bible is a lost art. However, at McKenzie, studying the Bible is not just an intellectual exercise. It's about learning to see this world and to see ourselves the way God does. It's about coming to terms with our sin and God's wonderful mercy. It's about truly having hope in this fallen world. If you are interested in knowing more, we would like to send you our tape catalog or our free monthly newsletter, News and Views. At the end of the program, we'll tell you how you can get in touch with us. But right now, here again are Jack and Christine.
Before the break, I was talking about how it's inexcusable for a husband, a Christian husband, to turn sexuality into just merely physical gratification. The reason, I think, is because in the biblical worldview, we as human beings are not merely animals. We are not just beasts. We are made in the image of God. And part of that means that that rational, moral side of me that sets me apart from the animals needs to prevail over the instinctual and the cravings, the passions of my physical nature, of my body. Moral degeneration normally will take us in the direction of becoming just animal-like, just beast-like. And we live in a culture that's actually beginning to celebrate our animal-like nature. Go out there and indulge and gratify yourself and just be the animal that you are. Most of human history has not given us that kind of permission. We live in a culture now that it's trying really hard to give us that kind of permission. It's wrong. It's completely demeaning. It's completely contrary to everything God intended human beings to be. So men in particular need to come to terms with, who am I as a sexual being? Do I have merely physical, almost animal-like cravings and instincts when it comes to sexuality? Yes, I do. Do I need to give rein to them and to indulge them and to simply yield to them? No, I don't. I can always stop and ask myself the question, but is this good? Is this right? Is this appropriate? Is this meaningful? Is this significant?
Is this loving?
And ultimately, is this loving? This will make more sense when we talk more about the role that sex plays in God's scheme of things, I think. But oftentimes, as men, we need to stop and realize that I'm going to have to go without my physical desires being gratified because it's not right now.
So, for example, looking at pornography is a way of just giving rein to my animalistic sexual desires.
Precisely.
Yeah. And I, even though I might desire to look at that and I might have a strong desire, it's wrong to do that. I need to not use my sexuality as any other animal would, but I'm created to use my sexuality in a very different way.
Yeah.
In context of a loving relationship with my spouse.
And using my sexuality to communicate that to her.
That she is special.
Yeah.
I think of a lot of people that I've worked with who have been sexually abused, and Jack, there are so many of those people out there. I've worked with more women than men who have been sexually abused. I think probably there are more women than men, but I don't have the statistics on that. And there is an underlying reason that sexuality has become very difficult for them. It's not just the sexual act that was committed against them, but it was the attitude along with the sexual act. It was not seeing their person. It was not caring about their person. It was not having that as a part of the context at all. But the person that was abusing them sexually was only looking at themselves and taking for themselves. And so now the person who has been sexually abused as an adult sees sexuality as something that's very negative, as something that's going to be taken from them, as a way in which they're not unique and special, but it makes them very impersonal, almost dehumanizes them, or certainly does dehumanize them. So to go towards somebody in a vulnerable sexual way, it just goes against everything in them. They want to run because this is the very thing that has hurt them. So if a man is to approach his wife in an animalistic way, not looking at her, not really caring about her as a person, but approaching her sexually just out of his own instinctual animal desires, especially a woman who's been sexually abused, he's going to have a very, very difficult time having a sexual relationship with his wife. And if he is responding to women through giving rein to his lusts in any way any form that might take, and then coming and acting as though he's very committed to his wife and being very, that she's very special, there's going to be, as you said, an undercurrent. There's going to be something that the wife picks up on that says, well, no, you really aren't special. Certainly lots of people struggle with lust. There can be the struggle and treat your wife as a special person at the same time. But that's different than giving rein, acting out on, giving up on trying to discipline my lust, and then being with my wife. I'm just pretending with my wife then. But if I see myself, which I will, coming up with areas of lust that I want to be involved in, or I catch myself in and yet don't want that to be true in my life, then I have a very different attitude and a very different approach to my wife, and she'll pick up on my struggle in a very different way.
What are the different ways that you see men, you described it, acting out on their lust? What are the different ways that you see that men do that?
Well, I'm a little bit uncomfortable with the direction of our conversation in that we're only talking about men as the ones who are sexually offenders.
Okay, how about sexual men, offenders? How about men and women?
Yeah, let's talk about men and women. Both men and women have a real difficulty in using their sexuality in appropriate ways. So what are some of the ways that men and women misuse their sexuality? Is that the way you put it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, how do they act out? I think you described it. It's one thing for, we were talking about men then, it's one thing for men to struggle with lust. It's another thing for them to give in to it, to yield to it, and in one way or another act out on that. How do they do that? What's going on? And we'll bring women in.
Okay, so men and women. Let me list a few, and then we can go back and talk about them. One way that you've already mentioned is through pornography. And pornography can be through the internet. It can be through looking at movies. It can even be on the TV. It can be through written material, actually script. It can be through pictures in magazines. Fantasy is another way that people will act out sexually in an inappropriate way. Looking at the opposite sex, undressing them, so to speak, or just fantasizing about what they would be like as a sexual partner in some way. I can prey or stalk my mate.
What do you mean by that?
I can need to be touching them in a sexual way all the time. I can make lewd sexual remarks. I can be touching them at times or in places that are inappropriate. I can wake them up many times during the night to have sex. I can just become a person who's got my eyes so glued on my own sexuality that I'm not seeing my spouse, but I'm asking for them to service these animal desires of mine. Another way that I can act out is to demand sex, is to say, you must give it to me or I'll go somewhere else. Or you must give it to me or I'll hurt you or somehow intimidate you in some way, withhold financial gifts or financial contributions to the family. And another way I think that's very common is by flirting.
Let me back up a second. And demanding sex, and I suppose that would include demanding particular sexual practices that the other person may not be interested in.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So lots of people who have not had very much experience with sex, I find especially with Christian couples who have tried to hold, those who have tried to hold themselves back and really not be sexual prior to their marriage, and also haven't had any sexual education or sexual discussions with an older person or someone who has been married for a long time, comes in pretty naive. And to be demanded to have, for example, oral sex, is a very, very difficult thing for that person. In fact, it seems very wrong to them. There's all sorts of ways to express ourselves sexually, and it seems to me that if both people are quite willing, both people want to be sexual in that way, that there aren't very many boundaries to being sexual in the context of a marriage relationship. But I think the boundaries certainly do come in when one person, for whatever reason, has a very difficult time with whatever sexual experience the other person wants to engage in.
It's really difficult from a biblical perspective, it seems to me, to get any sort of explicit drawing of boundaries on the sexual behavior of a husband and wife in marriage. But I can't help but wondering whether we have so stretched the boundaries in our culture and in human history generally, not out of a righteous kind of freedom, but out of the pressure of our animalistic desires. It seems to me that we always, as Christians, need to be asking ourselves whether, even though it may be mutual, a husband and wife are both agreeable to it or interested in it, are there not some things that we shouldn't be interested in? That is, are there some sexual practices that are just intrinsically perverse because the only reason we would be interested is that we have reduced sex to something that it was not intended to be or turned it into something else?
Now, as you're talking, all these images go through my mind, Jack, and I want to take back what I just said, that there's anything,
okay.
Anything is okay in the context of a marriage relationship, and I don't agree with myself. Okay. So let's go back and talk about that some, and we'll be right back.
I'd like to tell you something about Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a great books college. What does that mean? Well, one way to answer the question is to say that the focus of Gutenberg is reading and discussing books written by the greatest thinkers of Western civilization. Another way of answering the question is to describe what a typical day looks like for a Gutenberg student. The day begins by delving into the deep and elegant thought of the ancient Greek mathematicians. In front of his peers, and with their help, a student sorts through a carefully crafted proof penned over 2,000 years ago. Following, the students probe into the nature of written language and the study of classical Greek. It is here that he or she builds the tools for clear writing and skilled reading. Next, they learn of the rise of the Roman Empire. And throughout the week, students will hear lectures on Roman politics, art, religion, and philosophy. They will have the opportunity to ask questions during these lectures, gaining insight into the Roman state. They see how the Romans fit into the bigger picture of developing and declining cultures, which have brought us to where we are today. Then the day culminates with a discussion seminar on Virgil's Aeneid. Together, students seek to understand the story, sometimes exasperated and sometimes excited, but always engaged. After classes, informal discussions are carried on while others chat about the day's event. In the relaxed setting, a student spends a few moments getting to know an instructor. If you're interested in this kind of education, an education that focuses on growing in wisdom, listen at the end of the program for information on how you can contact Gutenberg College.
So before the break, I had to take back something that I said. I said that I think just about any sexual practice in a marriage where both people are agreeing is an okay thing. And I'm taking that back because I don't think that that's true. It's not okay to engage ourselves in some things that are very hurtful to one another and even very hurtful to our own psyche. Certainly the whole area of sadomasochism is a really wrong and inappropriate use of our sexuality. I have a lot of images, again, that come to my mind in regard to that, images that many people have talked to me about, that I've read about, that I don't think are appropriate to talk about on the radio. So I'm a little bit in a fix about how to talk about what isn't appropriate and give some people some information and yet be too specific on the radio where it's inappropriate.
Right. I think it's just important to make the point. People have their own experience and they have their own imagination. I think it's appropriate to make the point that we have to be critical-minded about this. And I like the way you put it. I think that's very well said, that some things are just intrinsically damaging to our own psyche. And if they are damaging to my own psyche and they mess up my mind with respect to my sexuality, it doesn't really make any difference that my spouse agrees to it or is comfortable with it. We are both playing with our own heads in a way that's not healthy, it's not constructive, it doesn't advance my sanctification, it doesn't make me into a man or woman who is entering into a godly expression of their sexuality. And if that's not the case, we need to run from it. We need to put it out of our life. Never mind what the culture is doing. Never mind that the culture is stretching the boundaries and putting it in our face more and more aggressively. We need to say no to it, that's not what sex is all about for me and my wife.
And we need to not determine whether or not we should do something based on whether or not I enjoy it or we both enjoy it. We can enjoy some very perverse things.
Absolutely.
And if people have a question about what we're talking about here today, what I would encourage them to do is to find a godly man or woman, a person that they think has some stability in this area, stability in their marriage, and to talk to them about some specifics. In fact, I think that's a good idea for any couple to do, is to find another couple, a mentor, to help talk through some these issues so that they have some fresh air that is let into their marriage. I really do like the idea of having a lot of sexual freedom in our marriage, and I don't want to come across as though we're saying, boy, you better just limit it to some very sparse sexual practices. I don't think that's true. On the other hand, I think that it can be very damaging to go to the lengths that our culture has in being sexual with our partner. Where do we draw that line? I don't think we can say that here on the radio today. But I think we should have some very good discussions with other people and try to look at what's loving, what's good.
I think you made a very important point by saying that finding it pleasurable should not be the standard. That's not the criteria. The criteria has to be much more moral and rational again. As a physical drive and as physical gratification, sexuality is very much like a drug. The adrenaline rush, the excitement, the physical response of my body to particular stimulation. You know, on the one hand, I train myself. I program myself to be stimulated by one thing or another. And in time, I need new and different and novel kinds of things to give me the same degree of physical charge and biological response as I had received previously. If I simply turn sexuality into a drug, if I simply allow it to be nothing other than a physical impulse, I cannot help but be led down the path of greater and greater perversion and degradation, because I'm going to, in order to get the same high and the same result biologically and physically, I'm going to have to look for new and novel, kinkier, more and more perverse things to do that. I should never enter on that road. It should never be something that I seek is the same high, the same degree of physical response. I need to allow my physical response to be whatever it is, because sex is not ultimately about that. It's ultimately about the very meaningful, comforting, profoundly joyful communication to somebody that they are dear and special to me. And it's that profound joy and emotional satisfaction that we should seek to sustain us in our relationship.
I really like that point, because as you were talking, I think that it's true that in the very beginning of a relationship, when people first enter into their sexual relationships, there is quite a high, and my sexual response is really big. What has been perhaps forbidden for me prior to marriage is now open to me, and it's very arousing to many people. But over the years, the same stimuli that was arousing no longer is. In fact, sometimes it ends very quickly when there is permission to do it through the marriage vows. So the question has to be then, how do I continue to be stimulated? How do I continue to enter into a sexual relationship that is satisfying to my partner and myself? And I think you said it very clearly there, is I seek to make my spouse, in every way that I can think about it, in every way that I relate to them and relate to them both directly and in my own head, I seek to make them special. I cherish them. I work at my relationship in such a way that I really do, at the deepest part of my soul, appreciate and love and care about my spouse and value them. It is out of that kind of relationship that my sexual relationship will be better. It will be good. It will continue to be stimulating to me. It will be much deeper and much more profound than it was in the very beginning. My sexual response today is very different than it was 20 years ago when I got married. If I could go back to then, I wouldn't. I wouldn't at all. I like my sexual response better now, because it is based on a knowing and a loving of my husband, and him knowing and loving me. And in that love and in that communication, our sexual relationship is a very, very precious thing to both of us.
Hopefully it's becoming clear then that, and again, I'll go back to a male perspective, that what husbands need to do is to guard that special place of their wife in their own minds, in everything that they choose and everything that they do. They just don't let themselves lust after other women. They don't look at them. They don't look at their bodies. They don't permit pornography to be a part of their life. And you mentioned flirting. They don't flirt with other women. That's more erotic than sexual. That's not on the same level as a merely physical gratification, but it's equally damaging to send the message to my wife that I want to play with the idea of being interested in other women. Robs her of that sense of her specialness, which is to rob her of the greatest joy of marriage. I mean, what an awful, cruel thing to do. That's why we go through this hard thing together called marriage, is because the joy that keeps us going, if we don't have a vision beyond this world to the eternal, the thing in this life that keeps us going is that deep sense of satisfaction that I'm dear to someone. Well, why would I continually be sending the other message to her then?
An area that I see coming out a lot for both men and women also is the whole area of fantasy. That without looking at any pornography, I might just be looking at another woman at my work or someone walking down the street or somebody in the supermarket and be very sexually aroused to them, in a sense, undress them or think about what it would be like to have sex with them or think about what it would be like to kiss them or go out with them or be with them. And so in my own mind, I can really generate a lot of sexual pictures that are inappropriate and again take away from the specialness of my spouse.
What would you say to the man who says, look, it's just normal male behavior. It's just, I can't help myself. It's just I'm programmed by God to respond to visual stimulus. Get off my back. Don't leave me alone.
Well, as a matter of fact, I hear that a lot. And it is very normal in the sense that it happens a lot. People are very much involved in looking at other people and projecting all sorts of fantasies. So if we're going to talk about normal, then if normal is the standard of should we do it or not, then we should say, yeah, everybody should do it because it's pretty normal. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we've got to ask the question, what's right? What is going to communicate to my spouse that I'm devoted to them, that I care about them, that I respect them, that I want to cherish them? If I want to communicate those things, and if I want a marriage that has a lot of good in it, and a marriage where we are mutually caring about one another, I can't be doing that. What do I say to that person, though, who says, you know, I want to stop, but I can't. I walk into a room, and I don't even expect it, and I see a woman, and she's undressed. It just came up for me that way, and I hear that a lot. Well, I say a couple of things to that person. One is, you might need to walk out of that room right at that very moment because there's something that's stimulating you there. If it's in a place where you're at a lot and need to be a lot, perhaps you need to change your routine or maybe even change your job. But that ultimately doesn't solve the problem, because if I have that kind of image coming up to me in my mind often, then probably there's a reason for it. There's something that's generating that kind of response. And I might need to do a lot of unpacking of what did I learn in the very beginning about sexuality? Where were some of these images formed in me, and how can I work at trying to reprogram myself in a sense so that these images don't come up a lot? So there's a lot of working on them and a lot of on a deeper level, and there's a lot of just plain old discipline of saying that's wrong and I need to walk away from it.
Yeah, it seems to me that what's normal, I mean, there's actually two ways of talking about normal. Normal in terms of statistically what's the average out there, but also normal in the sense of what did God intend and how did he create human males. And I think it's undeniable that God created human males to be very definitely visually stimulated and very sensitive visually. But the problem is not that a male would respond to beauty, to good looks, to a woman, and it would register that she is sexually desirable. That's not in of itself the problem. I don't think we can stop that. I do think that that is almost automatic, and I don't think that that's wrong, and we shouldn't beat ourselves up just because we perceive desirable as desirable. But what the question is, what do we do with it? The question is, do we stop it in its tracks and say, yes, she's desirable, so what? Yes, she's desirable, but that's irrelevant? Or do I go, yes, she's desirable, and let me think about that for a while? It's at that point that it crosses over from being just a natural male response to an unrighteous, ungodly activity. And it seems to me that the men you describe who walk into a room and immediately a woman is undressed, they didn't get there overnight. They got there after a lifetime of making choices to not stop their immediate response and put it in perspective and frame it the way that a godly person would frame it. They allowed themselves to indulge their fantasy and their imagination. And it seems to me that you're right. If I got there by programming myself, I can eventually free myself by reprogramming myself. I think that's right.
If I got there by programming myself, and or I got there by being programmed...
By someone else.
By somebody else.
Yeah.
Usually those two go together. I started by being programmed by somebody else very early. And I'm not talking about some formula of programming. I'm just thinking of parents allowing their children to watch inappropriate movies for any... I'm talking about some kind of abuse. I'm talking about kids being offered pornography. There's very many ways that kids can be, quote, programmed into having a sexual awareness that's inappropriate for children, and then carry that and magnify it in their adult life. They have a really difficult road to toe after they're 40 years old and they've been doing this for a long time. And I've seen a lot of people diligently work at this and make a whole lot of progress.
Over the years, a lot of people have come through Mackenzie Study Center. Some have come to study biblical interpretation. Some come to focus on applying the truth of the Bible to the world we live in. And others come for the great Bible teaching. And still others come because they need a place to think about their faith. What is Mackenzie? It's a group of people who take the Bible seriously, who see the goal of this life as the pursuit of righteousness and wisdom, who see the gospel as the most profound message in all of human history. The Mackenzie staff members have dedicated their lives to the pursuit of knowing the truth contained in the Bible. They see the need to get back to the Bible as more important than ever in this darkening world. Getting back to the Bible means trying to understand what the biblical authors intended to say when they wrote the Bible. And this can be hard work. The scriptures are often difficult to interpret and understand. Sometimes the Bible doesn't always say what we want it to say. But if we are to come to understand this world and our place in it from God's perspective, then the hard work of biblical interpretation is worth it. This is the passion motivating the staff and families of Mackenzie Study Center. If you are interested in knowing more about Mackenzie, we'll give you information on how to contact us at the end of the program. Then when you do, you might ask for some of our News and Views articles, such as Forgiveness, The Parable of the Unforgiving Servant by Ron Julian. In this article, Ron takes a close look at Christ's statement that if we don't forgive, we will not be forgiven. Ron's conclusion is that Christ meant exactly what he said. God's people know that they are sinners, and only the mercy of God stands between them and their deserved destruction. It is this humility, without which no one can come to the cross of Christ, which results in forgiving others. Ron argues that Jesus makes this point most forcefully in the parable of the unforgiving servant. Or you might want to read Jack Crabtree's Believing Without Seeing, First Reflections on Thomas. In this article, Jack argues that doubting Thomas has received a bum rap. Thomas merely demanded the same evidence of God's resurrection that the other disciples had received. Jack states, in the unfolding of the historical events, Thomas and no one else explicitly articulates what evidence he requires in order to believe. Jack goes on to say that this story highlights the extraordinary hurdle that exists for most people, for people like you and me, to come to believe in the resurrection of Jesus. Then he personally concludes, "I believe in the resurrection of Jesus, most importantly, because it makes so much sense in the light of everything I have come to understand and know about myself, about God, and about life in general." Or you might want to read Nancy Scott's article, "Making Contact with Postmodernism," in which she takes a close look at the popular movie Contact. Nancy shows us how this film clearly reflects our culture's changing views on knowing truth. For a Christian, this is important. Christians have always maintained that truth exists and can be known with ample certainty. Nancy shows that the story of Contact is a postmodern tale about the relativity and uncertainty of truth, that all truth is only based on one's personal, subjective experience. She states, "Contemporary films are one of the most powerful languages articulating truth in our culture today, and Contact provides an excellent example of how effectively authors can present their worldview. Ready or not, our culture has embraced the postmodern version of reality that Contact illustrates." Again, at the end of the program, we'll give you information on how you can find out more about Mackenzie Study Center.
Sex has become an area of deep and profound communication between my husband and myself. It's a language that we use that says, "You're special. I love you. I want to tell you that in ways that are unique to you and to our relationship. It's private. It's good. We look forward to it." None of that would be possible if my husband or myself were involved in an ongoing practice of violating our sexual commitment to each other, or violating our marriage commitment to each other by doing things that we've talked about today, by, as a practice, an ongoing practice, flirting with other people, as a practice, engaging our minds in fantasy about other people or sexual acts with other people, by being involved in pornography, by being involved in lusting after other people. All of those things would keep me from really looking at my husband and seeing him as special. They would rather bring my mind to a different place, a place where my sexual instinct just are animalistic. They're not involved in looking at and understanding and caring about another person, but they're involved just in looking at my own needs, my own selfish needs, and wanting to maximize my vision toward myself rather than toward him. It seems to me that sexuality is looking toward the other person as a way of loving them, as a way of saying to them that I care about you in the deepest of ways.
And I think that it is not only, I'm not only being unloving to my spouse, but I'm also really damaging my own soul and my own psyche, because I'm turning myself into something that God did not intend that I be. I am becoming just a creature seeking physical gratification, self-gratification, rather than a creature seeking to glorify God.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry produced by Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. This information will be given again in just a few moments. The staff members of Mackenzie believe their ministry is in constant need of God's mercy. They trust that God may use them for His purposes, and they hope their efforts will be valuable to others. They know that only in Christ can we truly have hope in this world. The Mackenzie Study Center is also a non-profit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.